So I want to do a bit of an update on the Group 7 thing that we talked about last week. I've actually bothered to do some research now, and I now know that it's Sophia James is the artist, and the song that she has released is called So Unfair. And further to our conversation a week ago where we said it had about 200,000 streams on Spotify, it has still had 200,000 streams, maybe a little bit more, which is, you know, not shabby. But it's not what you'd expect for the millions and millions of views of the TikTok.
I think we agreed it was 5 million at least views.
An awful lot.
There's lots and lots and lots. So what does that tell you? And where are we with Sophie, did you say? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Riding the Showbiz Wave, episode 9. Can you believe it?
So here's my thoughts. I think she's definitely capitalizing on the Group 7 hype because she organized a meetup in LA, where I guess she's based, last week, and did a 30-minute set. That tells me quite a lot in itself. It tells me she's only got 30 minutes of music that she can perform, so she's quite an early stage artist. But then I dug a bit deeper, and actually she was on American Idol some years ago and actually came 11th, which is not too shabby either. So she's clearly very good, and she's clearly had some public exposure, which also begs the question why she's not getting more views and listens.
And streams, yeah. Where is the real artistry on posting 7 clips throughout one day and then seeing where we are? I do find that a little soul-destroying.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think the elephant in the room is that I think the song is good. I mean, if I'd written that song, I'd be very happy. I think it's very well crafted. But I've got to be honest, it sounds a bit like it was written by AI. It sounds a bit like she typed in, can you write the next hit for Taylor Swift and maybe chuck in a bit of Avril Lavigne and maybe a tiny smattering of Katy Perry? And in the middle eight, can you write it as if Charlie XCX had written it? And and it's done it brilliantly. But it feels very, very contrived. And
for the record, we do not know that any of the above is true.
I would imagine it's not true. She co-wrote it with her producer, who is a guy who's written for BTS and various other people. He's a very successful writer and producer. So I should imagine it sounds, though, like it was written on a songwriting camp. It sounds like something that where a bunch of people got in a room, wrote this great hooky song, and that has no real substance, no real life experience thrown into it.
So that really is a fantastic example of the question that we've been throwing around on more than one of our discussions about technology, the speed and ease of digital communications within the sphere of writing, you know, brilliant music.
And the authenticity of artists. Because I think if she was more of a sort of bedroom artist writing, you know, on her own, you know, the song's called So Unfair. I don't get any sense that anything she's writing about feels unfair to her. It feels like she thought it was a good title.
Okay.
And it sang well.
I'm being very harsh. You are
being
very harsh.
And I'm sure there's some people that like the song. Maybe the 200,000 people that streamed it, or maybe they streamed it because they were interested, like I did. I'd be one of those.
Yeah, I have to say, and I stand very much with the artist and artistry, that what does that really tell me? I'd be fascinated to know how many people turned up to her gathering gig in LA. You know, were they, you know, sold out? Were the people queuing down the streets, or was it, you know, half a dozen?
That's one for next week.
Yeah, half a dozen mates. I do view that all, the whole Group 7 thing, as I said before, I'm not buying into that. I don't think it takes much in the way of talent to do that, to post and almost exploit TikTok. Now, people are going to laugh at me saying, well, that's exactly what young musicians are doing. I don't know. I would argue very strongly that it's not doing artistry any favours.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think, you know, part of the purpose of creating this podcast and putting the clips out on social media is to give people not direct advice, but for them to maybe glean some information about what we think about the industry and what they ought to be doing. And I think that a lot of advice that people have given is, you know, find some way of hooking people in, find some way of going viral, because going viral equals huge amounts of plays, which means huge amounts of fans. And I just think, you know, it comes back to what you're always saying, which is if the artistry isn't there, if there's not a genuine artist there that really feels authentic to people, that people can connect with, I don't think it makes any difference. And actually can be a curse rather than a blessing.
And the immediacy and the volume of your clip can do you a disservice, because there's no artistry there, and it's a load of rubbish. You're just getting in everybody else's way who is genuinely trying to distribute, you know, beautiful artistry. It's very interesting that the whole Group 7 debate has taken up a lot of bandwidth, not just with you and I.
It is a fascinating thing, I think, from our perspective, just in terms of, you know, sure, that's what everyone wants. You know, everyone wants that big sort of viral moment, because it's that moment to capture your audience and to grab them and go, hey, you know, look at me. And actually, I don't think that has worked for her particularly. We'll see. Well, I mean, time will tell. We said this last week. Time will tell. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she'll blow up as a big artist. But for me, she doesn't have, you know, when I heard Chaperone for the first time, I was like, wow, yeah, I love this. I get this. There was something, and I mean, you know, I'm definitely not the audience that she's targeting, but I got it. I got the artistry, and I got the depth of emotion and feeling in her music. I'm not getting it from this.
Well, do you think you've summed up perfectly what we all strive for? And it's not a very technical term, but it's the wow moment. You hear an introduction, and if that is all around us and quick and happens to be via TikTok, so be it. But what you don't want is to be that moment of TikTok where people go, nah.
I mean, it's interesting, because I think if that song had been, I'm talking about the Sophia James track, I think if that had been done by Taylor Swift, it would probably be a really big hit. It sounds like a Taylor Swift song, but it's not a bad song. It's quite catchy for a few minutes, but now I'm singing Avril Lavigne in my head, because it's quite reminiscent of some of hers. And it's quite reminiscent of it. And actually, I couldn't be bothered to actually waste my time analyzing it. But if I had been bothered, I would have been able to pull out little riffs and, you know, vocal melodies and things that were like other things. It felt like, as I said, it felt like an AI mashup.
I think that would be heartbreaking if I were an artist and somebody critiqued me and said, it sounds like a Taylor Swift song. I think I'd go and take a running jump.
As I say, it sounds like it was written in a songwriting camp as a placement for Taylor Swift.
And who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe it was.
I mean, lots of people love Taylor Swift, so there's no reason why people wouldn't want to write songs like it.
And of course now, I hate to say it, but given the complex and incredible nature of AI, you could probably do that.
This brings us on nicely to the other news of the week, which has been going on for about 10 days, but, you know, was announced this week, which is the settlement between Udio, which is one of the two big AI generation tools, the other being Suno, and UMG, Universal Music Group. And Universal, you're no doubt aware, but our listener might not be, have had legal proceedings going against them for copyright infringement of all the Universal catalogue. They've come to a settlement, and the settlement is basically they are now pretty much owned by Universal. I don't quite know how the deal is structured, but effectively, the only catalogue they can use now to scrape, to generate new works, is the Universal catalogue, and all works pay a royalty to Universal.
I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in terms of AI, because it will encourage people to use AI even more because somebody's getting paid. But it is very much a case of Universal being this, you know, a gargantuan institution of money, and they're acquiring, and if you can't beat them, buy them.
Yeah, you're right. I think the jury's out on whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that
my question would be, where does that leave the artist?
Well, the worry has been in the industry that Universal will use the technology to replace artists, not obviously their top tier pop artists and you know, other genres of art, music artists, but certainly people who write music for television, people who write library music, as it's known, production music, which goes into catalogues that gets placed within programs like Bake Off and The Apprentice and things like that. That stuff certainly has been rumoured, murmured about for a long time that Universal were keen to cut the composer element out of that. I think there may be some truth in that, but I think it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world. I think that it goes back to what we're always saying. True artistry will not be replaced by AI.
In percentage terms, what are these owners saving in terms of outlay? Let's say, and you use the word library music, they want to get rid of composed, human-composed library music and replace it with robots, right?
Mm.
What percentage of their overall revenue, or expenditure, I should say, is that? I can't imagine it's a lot, well, surely.
Depends on your deal, but if you're a library music composer, you're probably on a 50-50 deal on the performance royalties. Royalties are split into two, performance and mechanical. The performance being basically the writer, and the mechanical being the recording. Recordings, when you have a work commissioned, so if the BBC come to me and ask me to write something, they own the mechanical and they usually get most of the mechanicals. Sometimes I get a percentage. But with library, I keep some of that. It's usually split 50-50. It does depend. Sometimes you'll have two libraries involved. This gets super complicated, but you know, you'll have a publisher and a sub-publisher, or a production company and a publisher. You might end up splitting it three ways. But work with me, you know, let's say it's 50-50, certainly from Universal's perspective. So it's half the money they're losing. So effectively, it's worth twice as much to them as an industry.
I do think, and this is an accusation that is as old as the hills, that is a bit mean-spirited in general. You know, streaming revenues for artists has been the subject of much debate for years now, certainly in the, you know, post-Napster era. I just think it's a bit bloody mean-spirited. I get it. It's,
I mean, to be fair, they haven't said they're going to do that. No. In fact, they have actually said that they're not going to do that. So I think that, you know, that I think that there are fears within the writer community that they will. And I think the reason those fears are there is because it's an obvious low-hanging fruit that they can very easily replace.
I wonder, and this is probably, I'm just to hear what the listener thinks about computer games. We haven't really touched on computer games, which is such an interesting part of the business, especially when it comes to music. And as far as I'm aware, most computer games do have live orchestras and lookout studios. And
they generally have really huge budgets, and they work on a slightly different model. Some now are paying royalties, but traditionally they didn't, and the composers were often employed in-house by the computer developer,
right?
So they were staffers, so they would
and
be paid
ultimately away. Completely invisible composer. You would not buy your computer game because the music's written by Dream Master.
I think that's true, but I wonder, would you go and see a movie, if we take one of the biggest film composers of all time, Hans Zimmer, would you really be excited to go and see the new movie that Hans Zimmer scored unless you were a film composer or a massive score geek?
No, so that really underpins the fact that nobody really cares. No. So in the computer game industry, I would say that they would probably flip-flop over to AI well sooner than anyone.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Well, there's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I do know some people that are really big in the composition world for computer games, so I will ask them for next time, because that is a really interesting question. No one I've spoken to who seems particularly worried about AI for that at the moment. They're incredibly complicated to compose for, because you have to compose in layers and in a slightly open-ended way, because obviously different things happen when, you know, if you're wandering around a room and suddenly you go up higher and the music sort of feels more airy or something like that. There's so many variables that I think probably human interventions needed. Even if you were programming it with the AI, the work involved would be pretty enormous. But you're right. I mean, you could see a time not that far down the line where AI can work in real time with a game to actually create the score on the fly. based on your actions.
An area that we could probably touch on next week as we get into the dark and days of November is TV advertising and the tracks that people use and adopt as their. I don't know if you saw this week a huge news story about a retailer.
It must be the John Lewis ad.
The John Lewis ad. And the dad and the 12-inch vinyl.
Yeah.
And I think, is it Alison Limerick?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. For me,
it brought this here to my eye. I was watching it. I was watching it basically going, there's so much pressure on John Lewis. They are, you know, the every year it's like, what will the John Lewis ad be like? And they must feel that pressure to deliver.
To me, or is it that is that not quite niche? A guy in his 40s who clearly was a raver in his teens and 20s. I mean, it's very relatable, but
I'd be interested to see how it resonates with people. But I think, you know, I guess they've had to pick a demographic. I'd say it brought tears to my eye as much as anything, because I just thought, I was so impressed that they'd managed to pull it out of the bag again, do something totally
very
different.
Very different.
Completely different, yet really emotional ad that made you love the brand.
Yeah.
Because that's all they can do. I mean, they're a shop. It's like, what else do you do?
And a very un-Christmassy track.
Yeah, and even the ad's not that Christmassy, really.
No, I agree. I agree.
It's genius, in my opinion.
I would just love Alison Limerick to have a hit with it. I mean, it will. I guarantee it's going to be very successful on the streams. I don't know what it would take. Who knows? It might even chart top 10.
Going back to Udio and Universal. So there's been quite a lot of chat on both sides. So I would say from composers, there's been a slight sigh of relief. Because what they've done is they've said that they won't allow you now to download the music or to stream it outside of the Udio platform, which basically has killed the platform. And the other side of it is that Reddit is full of people who were users who are furious because they can no longer do anything. I mean, they can use all the stuff they created previously. There's an amnesty on that. But anything new, that's it. They can't now download it. And I think it raises a few really interesting questions, because I was asked to do something a while back with an AI vocal, and I was slightly reluctant, but I thought I would sort of explore what would be involved in doing that. And I had a look at using tools for that, and then I checked all of the licenses, and the licenses said you've got, you know, perpetual use, any type of use worldwide, as long as you've still got a subscription. So that's an ongoing cost. But then what happens if these terms and conditions change all the time? And so the terms and conditions for Udio have changed enormously overnight. So I went back to the production company and I just said, look, I can do it, but here are the issues. Firstly, I can guarantee you right now that you own the AI-generated vocal and you will be able to use it. What I can't guarantee you is that terms and conditions won't change. I can't guarantee you that the person whose voice was trained or was trained on was paid properly and won't come out of the woodwork and sue. I can't guarantee you that any artist who it sounds a bit like won't come out of the woodwork and sue. And within, you know, under a minute, they'd gone, let's just pay a real vocalist to come and do it. It was so obvious that that was the solution. And they were trying to save a few thousand pounds, but it was absolutely pointless and futile.
The Udio Universal issue, it's not just interesting from a creative and artist in terms of copyrights and the whole legal debate and what happens now, existing copyrights and age, and I think it's after 75 years.
7 days after you've died,
70
your work becomes public domain.
Yeah, so these... That will have a bearing on who gets paid what, when, however.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty complex. And I would say to anyone who's scratching their head thinking, I might give up and go and, you know, pursue another career, don't do that, because you can have a very, very fruitful time ignoring all this jargon.
Well, actually, I almost say the opposite, although I'd be saying the same thing. But I think if you're thinking about giving up, then definitely give up, because it's really, really tough. You have to have so much, you have such a thick skin. You have to be so tough and so much self-belief for all the knockbacks you're going to get, that honestly, if you don't want it enough to just do it because you have no choice, you're not going to make it. So I would say just take the tough love and just don't.
I actually fully agree with your sentiments, especially about if you're thinking you should give this up. Yeah, it probably isn't the place for you. But I do hope that in some ways, part of our conversations will encourage people to see what's out there, see what you have to do. Listen, it ain't easy and it's getting much, much harder, because I go back to my, probably the comment in episode one about, you know, to have, you know, a few hundred people who like your stuff just ain't cutting it. You know, yeah. you need to be in the elite group.
I mean, going back to the conversation about AI, I would also say that AI is coming for everything. So it's not like you can go, oh no, it's coming for music, so I'll go and be a doctor or I'll go and be a lawyer. It's coming for everyone. So just do what you love. And actually, the creative arts are probably one of the safer places to be in some respects.
Oh, I believe so. I believe that people, I've said this before, apologies if this is almost one, but people like people. They buy into people, they don't buy into product, they buy into people. So, and long may that remain the case. I know I watch certain movies just because certain people are in it. I watch certain people play sport because of the person.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely fine. And I think it's naive to think you get away without having a personality attached to your output.
Well, I mean, to use your sports analogy, I mean, I'm absolutely hopeless on all sports. Don't know who anyone is, but I can name you some footballers from about 30 years ago, if that's any use. But I would agree entirely. You wouldn't expect people to watch a football match with just, you know, 11 people aside running around. I do know how many people there are in a football match, running around without knowing who any of them are. It would be very dull. It's surely all about the personalities of all the people that are kicking the ball to each other.
I would love for one of our episodes, perhaps in season or series, as I like to say, two, is idols, sporting idols, pop idols, because there are parallels. And I will leave you with the thought that, you know, young people, they need to aspire. They need to tune into somebody. And the less free-to-air sport that we have, the worse it's going to get. It will become almost, mainstream sport will become elite. And I think that's a grave concern to our national sports that aren't well recognised. You know, take football, cricket, rugby, golf out of the equation for a minute. There's a whole load of other things. Who talks about track and field anymore? I mean, that's for another time. But I think the same amount of people like people. You know, I want exciting people to be performing at their highest. Something that I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to in the last some days, and if I were to say to you, have you heard the Paul Oakenfold remix of Step On by the Happy Mondays? But you'd think, hold on a minute, he did that in 1985. But he has done a new one.
Feels like 1990 to me.
Anyway, the point being that had our listener been hearing us, or me, extol the wonderment of this Paul Oakenfold remix that I've just heard, they'd be thinking, but hold on, didn't he do that in 1990? But he's done another remix just out this week, anniversary of the track, and it's wonderful. So, yeah, to avoid any confusion, I'm listening to a 2025 version of a Paul Oakenfold remix of Step On by the Happy Mondays, which is just marvellous.
You've been listening to Riding the Showbiz Wave with me, Drew Masters.
And me, John Fowler.